You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. And what have we got today, Hannah?
Today's clipping, and it truly is a clipping, it's quite short, comes from the Pondere Review on March 1st, 1918. Captain Best of the steamer Coyote, assisted by Mate Howell, has about completed a thorough overhauling of the boat and successfully launched her into the river a few days ago. With her new deckhouse and a liberal use of paint, she is being camouflaged into the appearance of a real steamboat.
Camouflaged into the appearance of. Okay. Welcome to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack. I'm here with Hannah, director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather, director emeritus, for our final episode on steamboats, at least for this year. Our guest is Chris McNaughton, discoverer of an important piece of Bonner County history. Hannah, do you want to introduce Chris further than that?
Yeah, Chris has been a friend of the museum for years now. I first met you, I think you reached out to the museum years ago asking for information about a dive you were working on, possibly the one at Trestle Creek. And we were just working together to see what we could find out about the wreck that you were exploring. And over the years, we've stayed in touch, and you've been our number one guy whenever we find something unusual under the water. So thank you so much for being here today and joining us to talk about your big discovery of a couple years ago.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so Chris, we're talking to a scuba diver. Are there different like classifications of scuba diver for people who actually know what they're talking about? How do you introduce yourself when you say you're a diver?
Yeah. So there's, several different certifications. Just the general term is just a scuba diver, certified diver, but you can go up to different levels from, the basic open water certification through advanced and pro levels and whatnot.
Hannah, jumping back to that clipping that you started us off with, why are we talking about the Coyote and Captain Best and his mate Howell?
So today we're going to be talking about a discovery that the community made and that Chris and his team helped us piece together. What we're going to try to figure out by the end of this episode is whether the boat they found was indeed the Coyote, or should I say one of the Coyotes. So that's our theory. We're going to see if we can get to the bottom of it.
We talked a lot in the last episode about names and repurposing of boats and so forth. So that completely makes sense. But I love this whole you're the expert of everything under that waterline. What was it that drew you to diving, and what was your first experience like being under the water in Lake Pondere?
Oh, in Lake Pondere, I would say that would probably be the Trestle Creek train wreck, which is over in...
it's by Hope.
Yeah, it's by Hope. It's about 100 to 120 feet. Sometimes it goes deeper depending on the water level. I believe it's from 1904, and it's just two boxcars, and then there's some ore down there. It's from a landslide that took out the boxcars that were sitting there a long time ago.
Oh, how interesting. So were you one of the first to come across that?
Oh, no. I mean, people have been diving on it for years. I actually don't know exactly who discovered it, but gotcha. I bet you it was probably sometime in the 70s or 80s is when a lot of things like that were being, people were finding them.
So this is where, my fantasies like kind of come into play. Not necessarily fantasies, but I think you're diving down and all of a sudden you see the boxcar and there's like the skeleton like up against the wall. So again, not fantasy, but imagination. Yes. Really takes place. And but was it like a time capsule when you came upon it?
Yeah. So the first time I did it, I did it with a friend of mine. His name is Austin, and we went through a lot of dive training together. And that was kind of one of our first fun adventure dives outside of the dive training world. And so we went down there, and in the lakes around here, right about 50 to 60 feet is where it turns into night. The sun doesn't go down that deep, and so you have to have dive lights. And sometimes the visibility is only a couple feet, you know. So you'll come up, you'll usually see just like a little outline of a structure a few feet from you, and then you get slowly closer to it, and then it kind of appears. And I mean, it definitely feels like a time capsule. You know, it's so cold down there, and there's not that much bacteria. So that wood from it's been underwater for over 100 years is in great shape, you know. Sometimes wood that's shallower is so soft and mushy, this is solid as can be, and they still have all the connectors that connect the cars together. Wow. And there's one box that fell in that's full of ore, and it still has the chain wrapped around it.
Oh my gosh. That is so cool.
So this, what time of year did you do this dive? Year and day, I guess.
I think that might have been, it's been a while. This was like 2017. I think this was probably September or maybe even November. It was later in the year.
Yeah. But still, I mean, not winter time or anything like that. So lake temperature on the surface, still possibly, you know, comfortable, swimmable. And I guess in November, a little less so. September, though, people are still out there swimming. But how cold are we talking when we get down to 50 or 60 feet or 100 feet below?
It's definitely between high 40s and low 50s.
Yeah.
There's an area at a certain point, and it can vary between 30 feet to 50 feet, sometimes even a little bit deeper, called a thermocline, where there's just a sharp drop in temperature.
Mm.
And around our area, it's so dramatic that if you have a diver in front of you that passes through that layer first, you can actually see him pass through the layer. He gets all fuzzy.
Whoa.
Oh, really?
That's incredible.
Yeah, and you know you're about to hit it, and it sucks because, you know, your face is exposed a little bit.
Yeah.
And so you kind of get like a brain freeze, like, you know, when you eat ice cream too fast.
Uh-huh.
It kind of feels like that for about 5-6 seconds, and then you get used to the temperature.
Yeah.
And you're wearing wetsuits for this?
You can wear wetsuits. Back when I was in my early college days and super poor, I dove in wetsuits year-round, really thick wetsuits. And then I got into dry suit diving, and I never looked back.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you were getting your certification just to go do this wreck, or were you already kind of diving and you heard about this wreck?
So actually, I grew up on Diamond Lake, which is over in Eastern Washington, and I wanted just to go scuba diving around there. In front of my friend's house, they had an old sunken wood boat that's about 12 feet deep, and I'd go snorkeling around it, and so I would, you know, dive down and look at it for a few seconds, then go back up, and I kind of wanted to stay down there longer, so I did that and started exploring Diamond Lake more, and we found a bunch of wrecks out there, but they're all, you know, small rowboats, you know, that pioneers built back in the day, and then when they got old and rotten, they just kicked them out, and down they went. So,
that's where the addiction started.
That's kind of where it started. I always found that really interesting.
Nice.
But most of the big wrecks have all been found. You know, Coeur d'Alene's full of old steamboats, but they all found those 50 years ago.
Wow. Where did you get your certification, or where did you do your training?
I did my training. It's called Boulder Beach. It's on the Spokane River. I went with a company called Atlantis Aquatics, which has been bought out by Jake's Scuba Adventure in Coeur d'Alene. And I think Jake's is probably one of the only ones still around. There's one might have opened up recently, but I can't remember.
And before we get into the wreck we're going to talk about today, what is the wreck that you've traveled the farthest for? Have you done any outside of kind of the Spokane, Sandpoint, Coeur d'Alene area?
I'm waiting for you to say the Caribbean.
No, I've never done that. It would be cool because that's where all the treasure
is.
Yes. I would say the furthest I've been would be like the Micronesia area. So I've dove. My first job outside of college was actually on the island of Saipan.
Oh,
which is north of Guam. And so there is lots of World War II wrecks out there.
Wow.
I would go down. I did some dive training on Guam for a little bit and furthered my education in the diving world. And I dove on two wrecks that were back-to-back. The hulls were touching each other. And they were both sunk. One was sunk during the First World War, and one was sunk during the Second World War.
Oh, my.
Oh, wow.
So you You could touch both hulls at the same time.
Very cool.
And then, of course, Truck Lagoon, if you've ever heard of Truck Lagoon. A lot of aircraft and ships have been sunk down there during the Second World War.
Ooh, kind of like the Bermuda Triangle-ish.
Kind of, but it was a war. They had a big battle out there. It was. Gotcha. It's yeah. It's kind of the premier wreck diving site of the world. I went out there on a volunteer mission and got to snorkel a couple wrecks. Yeah, I didn't really get to do much diving. It was a land-based mission, so.
Is it kind of a small world in terms of like scuba diving, wreck searching?
Yeah, the wreck stuff, I would say it's pretty small world because it's just not everybody's cup of tea. You know, I'd say the majority of divers get in it because they want to go see coral or see fish or something like that. Not too many people are interested in the wreck so much unless there's fish and coral, you know. So you come up here to Coeur d'Alene and Sandpoint and all this stuff, and there's not too much interest. People just dive on them just because they're there. But there's not a whole lot of people that are actually interested in studying them and learning about them.
What's the deepest that you could feasibly dive to a wreck?
Me specifically or just in general?
Both.
Okay, so me specifically, the technical certification lists me at 150 feet.
Wow.
And that's a technical diving certification. There's not really a set limit. Per se, it definitely depends on the equipment, the gas, and your knowledge and skills. You know, once you start going deeper, oxygen starts to become toxic. And so they have to do something called a hypoxic mix, where they give you less oxygen that would keep you conscious on the surface, and it gives you enough underwater. It just deals with pressure and how much gas your muscles can absorb. And then a lot of times they'll take a nitrogen out and they'll give you a lot more helium. Because helium's inert.
Huh. Interesting.
And so,
I know this is technically, scientifically possible, but it's fascinating to me that people, like, just willingly do this to themselves. They're like, yeah, I'll just go down 500 feet and start breathing helium because that sounds like fun. That does not sound like fun to me, Chris. I'm sorry.
Well, there's people do. Yeah. There's a shipwreck in the Mediterranean called the Britannic, which is the sister ship to the Titanic. Yeah, you heard of it?
I have.
And I can't remember the exact depth. You can look it up. But I want to say it's about 500 or so feet.
Yeah.
And people will dive it, and they'll spend maybe 15, 20 minutes on it.
Mm-hmm.
And every 15 minutes they spend down there, it takes 3 hours to go up.
Yeah, you have to stop. Yeah, stop on the way up and not get the bends, right?
Yeah. So you're pretty limited on time down there, you know, especially in something so big, you know.
I thought you were gonna say it takes 3 years off their life.
It probably does that too, you know.
Yeah.
So, I like how you mentioned some like why people dive, you know, and it sounds like history is like a big nugget of the why for you. So, history and adventure, would you say, are like two of the attractive concepts behind the sport?
Yeah, you know, I've been on some dive trips in tropical areas like Cancun and places like that, and it's fun, but after about the fifth or sixth day, you've seen all the turtles, you've seen all the fish, and you're kind of just bored of it. At least for me, some people can't get sick of it. You know, I think that stuff's gorgeous, and I love it, but I can only do about 3 or 4 days before I start wanting something else. And so the history and the adventure of, you know, finding something that's undiscovered is really exciting. You know, a lot of people do cave diving because you never know what's around the corner and when the next opening's going to be. And I'm not a caver. That's not for me. But, you know, there's a lot of those people that do cave diving for the kind of a similar interest, you know.
How deep have you been in Lake Ponderay?
Oh, I would say probably 130 feet is the max I've been.
And do you need – what are the safety concerns? Do you need a special oxygen mix or whatever? Do you just get to go down and just breathe regular air on your way down as you go through?
No. At these depths, usually about 150, I'll stay on regular air. I'm not trained for anything that's different than air. But usually about 140 to 150 is where I start getting narcosis. It's from nitrogen. You're overloading on nitrogen, and it's not dangerous. A little bit's not dangerous.
Yeah.
So, but it's kind of the same sensation of getting drunk. And so if you go too deep, you get too much narcosis. You know, it's kind of like you're getting drunker as you go deeper, and it affects your decision-making skills.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it affects my vision pretty quick. Mm-hmm. And so I won't go diving past 150 on air. Yeah. A lot of people do. I've heard of some people going down as deep as 200 on air.
Wow.
Mm. And for me, I just, if I feel that fuzzy at 150, 200's going to be really dangerous for me. So I don't, yeah. I don't mess around with that stuff. But yeah, and the lakes, 130 is kind of the recreational max. I mean, there's, mm-hmm. you know, then there's, you could get technical and be like, well, you're at altitude, so you got at minus 10 feet and it's cold and strenuous, so you got a minus 10 feet. So you could say it's like 110 feet your max, but uh-huh. at 130 yeah. is pretty much what we recreational divers stick around.
Yeah.
Mm. What are some of the most fascinating things you've found within like Lake Ponderay specifically?
Within Lake Ponderay. Okay. Well, the steamboat was by far the most interesting.
So that's like number one. So we'll get to that. Like old, mm-hmm. Well, the museum has, and I think we spoke to this earlier, but like this incredible encrusted cash register. Mm-hmm. So Hannah and I create, yes. and Jack, we're going to throw you in too, Jack, this fantasy about how they were gambling, you know, on one of these steamboats.
Yeah. And, you know, like sometimes you find the object and it's so hard to find the story behind yeah. it. But yeah, just like, why would there be a cash register yeah. at the bottom of the lake.
So it was a cash register, not a gambling machine?
Yeah, it was, you know, like about maybe 1 foot
robbery,
cube.
Mm-hmm.
Could be. Yeah. So actually, Coeur d'Alene has a lot of gambling machines on the bottom of it.
Oh.
And a lot of them have been pulled out because they used to have a gambling boat, and then during the era of Prohibition, gambling was also outlawed, and mm-hmm. so they just kicked them over the side.
Okay.
And several of them have been pulled up by divers in the past. There's still a few down there. And somebody, from what I understand, got one working.
Ooh. Oh, that's so fun.
Very cool.
How about diamond rings?
I've never found any diamond rings.
The classic
rings.
Wedding ring, dude, like,
I'm picturing
at
you
Beach.
Down there with a metal detector.
We've searched for them, but man, they're
hard to find.
Yeah. The most common thing we find is like cheap cell phones.
Oh, okay.
Sunglasses.
Burners.
Lots of sunglasses.
You've probably got a couple pairs of my sunglasses.
Yeah, I guess. Sure.
Yeah.
We all have that story.
Yeah.
I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, I remember you telling me about finding in the bottom of Diamond Lake like a lawn chair with a beer still stuck in the arm.
There was a lawn chair sitting straight up. There was a beer in the holster, and there was a bag of chips leaning against one of the legs. And it looked like it was set there on purpose.
Yeah.
We just want to get like a skeleton put on it.
Yes, there you go. Now, do you photograph your findings?
Sometimes. I don't bring the cameras as much as I used to. They kind of just get distracting, and it kind of takes away from the dive. So yeah. I always find the cool stuff whenever I don't have a camera.
Yeah.
But usually if I find something really neat, like a wreck or something like that, I'll mark it and I'll go back and get photos or videos of it if I can.
Yeah. And can you tell us just a little bit about what are some of the methods if you were trying to document, say, a boat or a train car or something? How there's a method of like videoing it that kind of measures.
Oh, photogrammetry?
Yes. Can you explain that?
So, okay, kind of, because I'm not good at that. Mm-hmm. Usually I find my friends that are good at that. But basically, you go around the wreck as much as you can and you take hundreds of thousands of photos, you know, pretty much as much as you can. And it's really hard to do at depth because you don't have a whole lot of light. But what you can do with it is you can plug it into a program and it will stitch all the photos you took together and it'll turn into a 3D model.
Wow.
And people have gone as far as 3D printing them and they'll get a full-scale model, you know, in front of them.
Yeah.
And that would be helpful sometimes because isn't there something, too, where I don't know if it's the pressure or what, but if you try to raise a wreck, especially if it's in deeper waters, it can kind of, isn't there something where the wood will just kind of crumble when it reaches the surface?
Yeah, so a lot of things will, but wood is one of the big ones in our area because most of our artifacts are made of wood. They will disintegrate because the cells have been infused with water. And so when it dries out, the cell walls will collapse. It doesn't have that same structure anymore. And so there is a preservation process. It's long and annoying.
And expensive, probably.
It can be expensive. There are some backwoods ways of getting around it. I'm working with the Kootenai County Historical Society in Coeur d'Alene. One of the rudders from a steamboat washed ashore last year. We pulled it out, and it's huge. It's probably about 6 feet long.
Oh, wow.
And it's 100% from a steamboat. You can go to a modern steamboat or an old one that, you know, is in a museum somewhere, and you can match that part up right there. Mm. It's from a paddle wheel. We think it's from it's called the Georgie Oaks, which is from the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. And I have that sitting in a bath at my house right now.
Oh.
Getting
Six
ready.
Feet We're, long in your bath.
Well, it's in a bath. It's mm-hmm. I have made a bath with some tarps and some okay. materials
I was
out
like
in the yard.
I was thinking you go upstairs and
it's like in the shower.
No,
in your shower.
I need the shower for myself.
Uh-huh. I was like, really self-sacrificing.
But, you know, we've searched all sorts of ways to preserve it, mm-hmm. And through like the most professional ways, which is ordering these special chemicals, which cost mm-hmm. thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And then just from researching, we found other ways where you can use sugar mixed with the water over time, and that will keep the cell structures from collapsing. And so we're setting up a meeting probably within the next week or two to discuss like how this is going to go about. But they're thinking that like maybe a lot of local places can donate sugar and make it a community project.
Yeah, that's a great idea. The sugar can be expensive.
It's a lot cheaper than,
right, that's
than
true.
The chemicals. Yeah. But yeah, it's still up there in price. So.
So a preservation expert as well now.
No. Not expert. I've read
Supporter.
A book.
Oh, so the most exciting find you found was right here in our neighborhood near Sandpoint. You said. Should we talk a little bit about how that first came to our attention?
Sure. Do you want to start us off?
Yeah. So at the museum, we received a call from Donna Klein. So thank you, Donna, if you're listening. She let us know that there had been some drone photography taken by a real estate agent. And in one of the photographs, they saw what looked like the outline of a boat. And it looked like a big boat. You know, much bigger than a rowboat, bigger than a, you know, standard kind of modern day motorboat. And so that piqued their interest. They reached out to us at the Historical Society and said, hey, do you guys know about this? Can you tell us what it is? And we were like, we don't know anything about that. But we have a good friend who is a diver. So let's loop Chris in and see if he can help us figure it out. So that's when we reached out to you. And do you want to tell us a little bit about how you prepared for that dive?
What was it like getting that phone call?
Well, when I got the original phone call, I was so busy I could only talk for about 4 seconds when I was like, Hannah, I gotta go. So I knew there was a boat found, and then I kind of had to put it in the back of my mind. But mm-hmm. then, you know, when I had a moment, I sat down. I actually think I talked with Bree, mm-hmm. And she gave me more information about it. She didn't mention how it was big. She just said that they found a boat in the lake, and they want someone to go look at it. I was thinking it's probably going to be something like 12 to 16 feet, like an old rowboat, you know, and it's still pretty cool. I'd still definitely go and check it out, but, you know, nothing that's that groundbreaking, because there's a lot of those still around, and you know, we find those quite a bit. And then she sent me the pictures, and it was clear as day. This was huge. This had to be at over 50 feet, which there hasn't been a discovery that big on either Coeur d'Alene or Pend d'Oreille since I believe probably the 70s.
So you were like, this is my moment.
Yeah, it was all about me.
So it wasn't just you who came up for the dive. Do you want to talk about how you put your team together for the dive?
Yeah, so I'm a hobbyist archaeologist. I am not a professionally trained archaeologist by any means. And so I can do a lot of that stuff on the small wrecks where, you know, not many people care about them, and it's pretty cool. But something this big, I was like, okay, we need to get people in here who know what they're doing. So I reached out to a friend of mine. We're in the same club, which we'll talk about later. His name is James Delgado, and he's a very well-known maritime archaeologist. He lives on the East Coast, so I knew he wouldn't be able to come over here and help us with something so small when he's, you know, doing some of the grandest wrecks in the world and whatnot. But, you know, he knows people who could help out. So I got in contact with him, and he reached out to a gentleman named John Pollack, who lives up in British Columbia. And that he and James went to school together, and that's how I knew him. And John was the right guy. John had been studying these type of steamboats for most of his career, and has discovered countless steamboats up in the British Columbia region. And so he and his partner, Bryant Nadwidney, came down from Canada. I think they drove, I think it was like a 4-hour drive. Wow. They came down just for the day to help us with this project. And then I brought my friend Austin Vallone and his wife, Kaylee. They came up to do some photography and some drone work so we could get some pictures of it. And it was just, it was a really neat project putting it all together.
I bet the energy was pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah. We were all thrilled. It was cold. It was a very cold day, but it was, we were all looking forward to it.
So we got the first call about this discovery at the beginning of February in 2024. And I believe the day you did the wreck was March 5th or 6th of 2024. So about a month later. So... yeah, it was a little chilly. I remember being out there on the shore, being bundled up in my puffiest coat with the rest of the museum staff and some folks from the Dover Historical Committee. But you guys were actually in the water. So what was that like temperature-wise, like just kind of going into the water and seeing what was there? Can you walk us through what that experience was like?
Well, the three of us were... pretty experienced with the cold water stuff, so we kind of knew what to expect. We knew it was going to be cold, but when you're in a dry suit and you have a thick undergarment underneath, it's bearable. You know, the worst part is your feet and your face. Those are the parts that get cold as fast as, at least for me. And so you kind of just, once you get suited up, which takes a while, it can take about 20 minutes to get ready, and you go hop in, you know, and your face is cold instantly, and then the exposed skin starts to go numb, and you're good from there on out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that first getting in part, you're never looking forward to. It's always just...
It's like getting out of the hot tub.
Yeah, you know, exactly. It's like you're there for the mission, you know, not to have, not for the fun of it, but it's still fun. You know, you're still having a great time, and that's what was cool, is both John and Brian, you know, they're not complainers, and it's very clear that they were not burnt out from the work that they do. So when we got out there, I mean, it was just, it was professional and, and well done, the study that they did, but it was also a great time.
Oh, that's so cool.
Brian, he took all the underwater photos while John and I did a lot of the measurements and kind of studied it from the outside. So it was a really neat experience to get, you know, this team together, because... It wasn't we didn't have anybody on the team who was complaining or having a bad day. Everybody was there to have a good time and just do it for fun.
And what made this dive exceptional for your team?
I mean, it was just the people, the conditions. There was no wind. It was really cold. I think there was still some ice on the water at some parts, if I remember right.
Yeah, a little bit on the shore. And so just think, this was when, so in March, the water is still down in the winter. So right now, when you're hearing this in July, the water is about 10 feet higher than it was when they were doing the dive. So so right now there's a lot more water over the top of this wreck than there was when you guys were there.
And that's one of the reasons we wanted to go do this. Is one, we could measure the depth of it when the water's low. It's easier to find, and the current is a lot weaker. And then come summertime, I went back over with my boat and did another little study on it, and the visibility is actually not great in that area when the water's high. It's only a couple feet. The current is, it's not too strong, but it would be a challenge, and it would be harder to find the wreck. And so doing it during that time, we got the... we got to record, you know, what it is at low water versus high water and all these other factors that make sense to why the wreck has degraded the way it has.
Well, yeah, what was the state of it?
It was pretty bad.
Was it?
It was, the hull was intact, but there's, they had plating, metal plating on the side of it, which is an unusual feature on a lot of steamboats. Mm-hmm. Usually it's just wood, but this one had actually metal plating, so it was used year-round so it could break through the ice. And that was peeling off, and just most of the top of it was gone. But there were no burn marks, which was interesting because a lot of times they used to burn them. This one was just stripped down and sunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember looking at the aerial photographs that Austin took. It's very clear in the bow of the boat. You can see the kind of pile of rocks that they put in there to weigh it down.
Well, so there's argument that that's actually ballast.
We thought
originally that it was used to sink it, and it still might have been, but the region that it's at, they would use some ballast up there to outweigh all the machinery that's in the stern of the boat.
Oh, yeah.
It's very possible that that's what that was. And why remove it, you know? Probably was in there when they built it. And so.
Wow.
But we do think the ship was scuttled. Scuttled would be the term, I think.
That's a feeling sailor.
Yeah. Anyway, go on. But yeah, it wasn't an accidental. There wasn't a disaster.
Correct. Like yeah. The few things that we can know for sure, we know for sure that it was scuttled.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I have a list here of the findings from the wreck that you guys put together. It says that the vessel is from 1910 to 1929. Do you remember like what details you saw on the boat that would have helped your team date it to that time?
There wasn't a whole lot out there. John Polek took a guess while we were on the water that he's thinking maybe early 30s.
Okay.
But with all that was left there, it's really hard to know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like you're going to go down there and find some piece of metal that has a stamp on it because everything's so rusted over. I will say there's bottles nearby that were from the late 1800s that could be related to it.
So they were drinking when they sunk it.
It was actually medicine bottles that we found. You know, and I don't know, those could have been in there for, you know, 10 years or something like that.
This reminds me of my medicine cabinet where everything's, you know, 20 years old.
Yeah. You know, they probably didn't know about medicine expiring a whole lot back then. So, and some of them were from later times too, but those also could have come from a mill. Mm-hmm. That was in the region. Yeah. So it's not necessarily into the boat. It's hard to tell. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's very clearly activity between 1800 through 1930.
So cool. So it's an evaluation of the site with the object as well.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And part of the wreck was missing, right? So it says that what was there when you were diving, you measured at 66 feet, but that likely the boat was 70 feet long or maybe a little longer.
Yeah, that's right. That was kind of our guesstimate that we made on that. The stern of the boat's missing a good chunk of it, and we don't know where that stern is. I don't think it's any deeper. In Bayview, there's a stern of a steamboat down there with the propeller still on it, and actually it does technically match the descriptions, but the...
Well, I was going to say, Cap just cut it off and threw it on another boat.
Probably.
Yeah, no, so it's like, I don't know... Who would tow something like that all the way down to Bayview just to sink it there? You know, it just doesn't seem like make any sense to how it could get down there. But it is technically possible.
That's so neat.
And I do not know enough about boats to understand the significance of this. It says that it's incredibly rare for a flat-bottomed riverboat to be driven with a single propeller because most riverboats would have used paddle wheels at the time. So that's just another feature that I think that John noticed and that has helped us kind of narrow down which boats this could have been as far as identifying it.
Right, because the rivers were a lot shallower back then because they didn't have any dams. Mm-hmm. And so the paddle wheels would just skim across the surface so they can get into really shallow parts of the rivers. Mm-hmm. Whereas with a propeller, you're very limited to where you can go.
Sure.
Because those are designed for deeper water.
Right, yeah. You know, certain ports you probably couldn't get to because, you know, they didn't have the technology to dredge things as easily as we have it today and make things deeper or to dam up a river and make it deeper. Hmm. So paddle wheels were a thing.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. So that's the demise of the paddle wheel is in part due to the just the technology that allowed the rivers to be deeper than
steamboats just aging out and not needing them. Roads were being built to places and they don't need the boats any longer, and paddle wheels were not very efficient.
Yeah. Okay, but this boat was not a paddle wheel. It was a 60-foot 60-foot propeller driven craft that, and 60 feet, I just had to look it up. I always go gauge the size of boats based on the Shaunetes, because we're all kind of familiar with that, the Pendre Tours boat down at City Beach, and that's a 40-foot vessel. So this is one and a half of that, and that's one of the larger boats, you know, at least most visible large boats on the lake. So this is a big deal. I think I've taken us a little bit off the beaten path here, Hannah. You have more facts you wanted to read about what we found out about the vessel?
Sure, yeah. After Chris and John and the team and James did the dive and put together a report of their findings, took a bunch of photographs to help us understand what remains today. Then all of that information was shared with our team of researchers at the Historical Society, primarily Dan Evans and Will Valentine, who I'm sure you'll recognize. They're the researchers behind many of our episodes. Yes. And they were so excited and determined to help narrow down which boat this
they
could have been.
They got to work. They jumped out of their seats.
They're like, another puzzle?
History.
So they kind of looked at what you guys discovered about this wreck, took all of those measurements and factors into consideration, and put together a short list of boats that it could have been. The four boats that they came up with were the Elmina, the Diamond D, the Bullfrog, and the Coyote. And then they started to narrow it down. So the Elmina was built by Cap Markham, as many of our boats were, and named after his mother. It was a sternwheeler built in 1890, but in 1908 it was damaged, needed a new boiler, and was sold. So as far as we know, that one did not actually sink. The Diamond D was an 80-foot twin screw, which that was the one they were kind of like hoping that it would be, because it has a really significant historical background. But apparently the wreck that you guys found was a single screw instead of a twin screw. And I don't know what those terms mean at all.
Screw just means propeller.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so the Diamond D had two propellers, which ruled it out as being the sunken vessel. The Bullfrog was used by the A.C. White's Lumber Company in the same vicinity as where this wreck was found. But the Bullfrog was only 46 feet long, so that kind of ruled that one out, which left us with the Coyotes. There were two steamers used by the Dover Lumber Company and A.C. White during this period of time. And just by kind of virtue of elimination, this has been our best guess to date of which boat this wreck might be, which is really exciting to me because the Coyote One, the museum has the anchor of the Coyote One on its front lawn. So this is kind of a piece of related history you can go
see. I mean, talk about full circle and how that boat like called to you guys all. You know, and was like, come find me. Yeah. You have parts of me already.
Were you involved when you were the curator of the museum in installing that anchor?
That one was done before me.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have had people comment that it's an absurdly outsized anchor for any sort of boat on Lake Pendere. Yeah.
I always smile and nod when that happens.
If you stop by the museum, you'll see it. It's about 4 feet long.
It's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm.
Looks
it's
like
incredible.
An anchor that would come off a pirate ship or something. Yeah. It's very cool.
It's the best. And related to Cap Markham as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Cap Markham did build both of the coyotes. And like we talked about in the last episode, this was a classic reuse situation. So he built the Coyote One, eventually he used parts from the Coyote One to build the Coyote Two. We found this sort of charming quote from an interview with Bob Selle from 2001 talking about the Coyote. He said, "One thing I remember, they used to have one tugboat we called the Coyote because its whistle evidently had a disc in the barrel of the whistle and it'd go whoop, whoop, when it was whistling, and you'd hear him whistling for a long time to make sure they had it open for him when they got down to the bridge, so that they had a lot of logs on the water behind the tugboats. So this is, I think we talked about this in one episode, with the long bridge, if they were tugging log booms, they had to be really careful as they navigated the log booms underneath the piers of the bridge so that they didn't get stuck. We have some photos of them getting kind of log jams underneath the bridge and having to go out and sort of do the river pig.
True industry thing. Happening. It would be so incredible to see that today. The log jams underneath the long bridge.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
Not very fun, though, if you were trying to navigate it. So, wow. I mean, bringing more of the Coyote back, you know, to the surface. Mm-hmm. So what did that mean to you and your team?
Well, you know, for a long time, and technically it is still a mystery, you know. We haven't been able to verify it, but I agree with Hannah's theory. It definitely does. Match the description pretty closely. But for a while, it was a complete mystery. You know, we searched the records here at the Bonner County Historical Society. We searched records over in Newport, Washington at the Ponderay County Historical Society because they did have some boats that made it up that way. But it's really challenging because a lot of times boats were... They ripped the tops off of them, and they sold the hulls, and the hulls went to different lakes. And so, you know, it's kind of hard to keep track. But usually when one goes down in a lake somewhere, they have some sort of record of that vessel just being on that lake and a lot of times being scuttled. Is there any record of the Coyote 2 being scuttled? Do we know?
There's a record of the Coyote 1 sinking, them pulling it back up.
They were like, just kidding.
Reusing pieces of it to rebuild the Coyote 2. As far as the Coyote, I think they did find, while we're chatting, I'll take a look through my notes here. I think they did find a note about actually scuttling the Coyote 2. So I'll take another look while we're talking about the Explorers.
Yeah,
Club.
So you were talking about a club, but the Explorers Club?
Yeah, so what made this pretty neat was this was my first Explorers Club flag mission. So for those of you who don't know, the Explorers Club is a very old club that's based in New York City, full of people who are explorers, adventurers, scientists, filmmakers. You know, the list goes on.
I imagine like the Titanic.
Yeah, the Titanic.
Cameron's part of it.
Yeah, James Cameron's part of it. Elon Musk's a part of it. Who's the Amazon guy? Yeah, Bezos. He's in it. You know, so you got a lot of big names in it, but you also have a lot of, you know, little guys like me who do. I call it backyard exploration. You know, we're not going in and getting our names in all the magazines, but you know, we still are. They still recognize us.
Did they reach out to you, or did you submit to be a part of the club with your findings?
You have to submit an application to be a part of it, and it's quite challenging to meet their standards.
Did you have to like sell your firstborn?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
It's you have to. The biggest standard is you have to have directly contributed to something scientific or important in that manner in some way, shape, or form. It's a lot of times your findings have to be published somehow, and then you have to have two people who are members of the club to recommend
the
you.
The invitation.
Yeah.
It's so secret
exclusive.
Society. Love it. So when did this start, the Explorers Club?
Ooh.
I think
1904.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I always like back to like the mustache and like the
and think like Everest climbs, yes. Like everything from the bottom of the sea to the highest peaks.
The most extraordinary people.
Yeah, they have. You can go online. I think it's Teddy Roosevelt's application to the club.
Was he rejected?
No. Teddy Roosevelt was quite the explorer.
That might bite you later.
But you know, you read the. And the application, of course, has changed a whole lot since then. But you read his description of why he should be in the club, and it talks about all his adventures and whatnot. And then the very last thing is a little side note says, was president of the United States.
If you needed a tiebreaker.
That is so cool.
So, yeah, it's had a lot of notable people throughout history. It's a really interesting organization, and it's a great way to meet a lot of people.
Oh, I imagine.
Further your exploration by not only getting contacts, but also being able to get different grants that run through the club as well. So
very smart.
There's a lot of good reasons if you're doing certain types of exploration to be a part of the club.
So do you all meet like once a year in New York?
Yeah, there is an annual dinner, and it's pretty grand.
Oh yeah, I mean definitely. I see the Chesterfield sofas, the right cigars.
Oh yeah.
A lot of cackling.
There's a lot of stories. I never have been actually to the annual dinners.
You have to.
They're,
you have to report back.
I'll let you know. Maybe I'll go next year and I'll let you know. I know
just for the radio show, please.
I know they had Justin Bieber wanted to buy a whole table at the annual dinner, but they wouldn't let him do it. He's not a member.
You can't just buy your way in.
Yeah, that might be a rumor. Someone mentioned that at our chapters meeting last year.
So, do you do mostly Zoom?
No, there's a Pacific Northwest chapter,
oh,
so I'll go to some of their meetings. Mm-hmm. They don't have them as often as I wish they did, mm-hmm. But, you know, so they do have them, and I go there, and you meet some real cool people. You know, one of the guys who was a sponsor for me, his name is David Concannon. He's dove down to the Titanic in the submersible. Who knows how many times.
I think my heart just skipped a beat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of Titanic people in the club.
Oh, wow.
We had, I can't remember the gentleman's name. He just died in a plane crash last year. He was an Apollo astronaut.
Oh, wow.
And he took the famous photo called Earthrise.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing. And so he was in the club. I never got to meet him. And then there also was... a gentleman who was on the first dive to the Mariana Trench. I believe Walsh was his last name.
Fascinating.
That was a pretty famous expedition as well.
Are there any of these people who are, you know, a particular hero of yours or someone whose expeditions just make you think, like, wow, that's what I want to do someday?
Gosh, you know, I mean, so I loved Titanic growing up as a kid, mm-hmm. So James Cameron's pretty cool. But, you know, I'll probably never get to sit at his table.
He's probably way up at the one up on the platform.
You certainly should go, just a sec, you know, to some people at your table and go run over and just shake his hand.
Just push Elon out of the way.
Just turn your back.
Put me butt in.
Yeah, so, you know, I really like his work with his movies. I really thought... it was pretty cool because a lot of that filming took place on the actual wreck. Mm-hmm. And so they did a lot of studies before the dives. There's a gentleman here. He actually has a place on Lake Pendere. His name is Guy Zients. Mm-hmm. And he worked on the diving aspect of the film. And he was a member for a while. And I think he just stopped going. But he's been down to the Titanic, I think, a couple times. He went to the wreck of the Bismarck, mm-hmm. Which is a famous German battleship from World War II. You know, and he's just lives practically down the road.
Huh.
And that's he talks amazing. About, he's like, oh, yeah, I worked with Jim. And, you know, when he calls him Jim, it's James Cameron. You know?
So this may be a wild rumor, but I heard that James Cameron made the movie Titanic basically as an excuse to be able to dive to it.
I think I asked Guy that one time. I think he said that was true.
I love everything about that.
Yeah.
Oh, so incredible.
I've heard that as well. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We're talking with Chris McNaughton, who dove to the wreck of what we think is the Coyote 2. on the Pendre River in 2024 and made that, I guess, it's a rediscovery more than a, not to take away from the discovery, but if somebody knew that it was there and then it was forgotten by history until it was rediscovered.
And it became your Titanic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's my Titanic. You know, except mine is 3 feet deep.
Yeah. So, I think that's something that's so interesting to me is that it was a surprise that it wasn't known that it was there. Because obviously this was done on purpose by somebody at some point, and they just didn't write it down, or they didn't mention it, they didn't put it in the paper, and they just said that boat's gone.
Yeah, you never know what is going to be important to people. They might just say, like, oh, we're sinking another boat.
Hey.
Yeah.
You know, kind of just a normal thing to do. I did find, so this is the last we heard of the Coyote 2, from the Northern Idaho News on January 10th, 1936. It says the Coyote 2 steamboat partially sunk last week, and Fred Hodge has had a crew of men with forestry pumps working to raise it. They procured another pump from Priest Lake Tuesday and succeeded in getting it up. This part is speculation, but what may have happened is that the Coyote 2 was raised after sinking at the Dover Docks in January of 1936, was stripped of anything of value, and then purposely sunk again, just kind of off the end of the Dover Dock. And I know when you were showing us the photos of the wreck, there was virtually nothing on it that was metal or anything that, you know, would be something that you would kind of try to salvage, which kind of just speaks to that reusing and repurposing materials from all of these ships as they were kind of laid to rest.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, you said 1936 that was? Yeah, that's about the time the steam era was really coming to an end. And so with the damage done from the sinking and the hull already being quite old, having been part of the, you know, Coyote 1, it could have just been not reasonable to repair it. You know, it could have been, you could take this stuff off and sell it or put it on a new boat that is, you know, much more advanced, you know, not steam powered anymore, because that was, we were kind of switching over at that point to different, more modern type vessels.
So just not worth salvaging.
It's possible, yeah.
And it's in deep enough water that it's not a hazard to navigation?
Depends what time of year it is.
Okay. Hey, that surprises me, too, that they didn't try to take it out. I mean, there are deep parts of the lake, you know, that they didn't try to get it further from navigable waterways. But
so
I guess they thought that was good enough.
Absolutely.
Know.
What is next for you? And like, what's like a dream dive, or what are some of your goals with diving?
Oh man. Oh, I'm not ready for that question.
What's your future look like?
I do not know. I just kind of like being local and setting the local wrecks and helping out the different historical societies.
So incredible.
I think that's really fun, and it doesn't cost a ton of money. You don't need grants to go and do it. But you know, it's still, no one else in the area is really doing it. And so it's kind of fun to be the guy who does that.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, we sure appreciate your time, your talents, and your enthusiasm for this.
Well, thank you.
Are there any other, do we know of any other, like, I guess, big lost boats, trains, anything in Lake Pendre that Chris should be out there looking for?
You just got to read the newspapers. Uh-huh. I think if you search the word wreck in the local newspapers, you'll come up with about 1,000 different results. Yeah. So
there's definitely more down there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what condition they're in, but I would say there's definitely more down there.
Spooky stuff, though. Is it? Have you ever been? Well, you only go down 150 feet, so you've never been down in the really deep 1,000 feet part of the lake.
Right. Yeah. No, I haven't done that.
Have you ever been like tickled or touched by something that is unexplainable?
I think Heather's giving a hint to one of our upcoming episodes.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing.
What lies beneath the mysteries of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
No, I haven't had that. So I hate to.
Maybe there won't be an episode now.
But what I will say, largemouth bass are very, very curious fish, and they're and they can be really big.
In this lake, yeah.
They love to hang out over your shoulder, a few inches from your face.
Creepy. Oh, man.
And you don't know they're there until you turn your head and there's a fish staring right at you. And I mean, this thing is, they're ginormous.
Yeah.
And so that's
how come
terrifying.
We can't catch any of those?
Because they're smart.
Yeah. What is it like down there, not near this wreck, but when you're down near the train wreck? You know, down 100 feet or so. Is there vegetation? Is there? I mean, do you see a lot of fish? Is it kind of a?
No, it's like a lunar landscape.
Yeah,
it's for the most part dead.
Yeah,
a lot of very fine silt that's very easy to kick up and destroy your visibility.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's boulders. There's really not any logs to come across once you get so deep. Every now and again, there's an occasional one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, I mean, you know, like going back to movie Titanic, you see the beginning where the submarine's down below. That's very much what it looks like. It looks like you're at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
But you're only 100 or so feet below the surface.
Yeah. But just, no light penetrating down. So there's no plants to,
Not really.
That's weird.
Some small fish on occasion, but nothing big.
Yeah.
Too spooky for me.
Likewise. Yeah. And you can't see anything without a flashlight.
Yeah, you turn them off, and sometimes there's like a green haze you can kind of see, but it wouldn't be enough to do a safe dive off of.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're excited about this, so that we can sit on shore and just see what you find.
Likewise. We've nearly come to the end of our time here. Thanks so much, Chris, for being here talking to us about diving Lake Ponderay. We hope to talk to you again when you find that next big wreck out there. Hannah, what's coming up at the museum in the month of, as we close out July and heading into August?
Yeah, we've got a busy couple of weeks coming up this Thursday. Actually, let me think. We're pre-recording this.
Yeah.
Okay. So these events will have already happened. So we have coming up on August 1st. That is our free first Saturday. And that is sponsored by Kathy Hubbard and Keith Congleton. Admission is free that day, and we're open from 10 to 2. And we will have hands-on history activities thanks to our sponsor, Ruth Lever. So come out, and if you have kids, bring them out for some fun hands-on history activities. Our Hall of Maps exhibit will be open. That's our newest permanent exhibit, and we have over a dozen maps from the museum's collection that show everything from Ponderay paddler sightings to different...
That one's like world famous, Hannah.
Yeah, to different plans people had for how City Beach should look, to early maps from Father De Smet. So all kinds of amazing maps from our collection will be on display from now, and it's on permanent display, so you can come in anytime and see those. We also have our historic walking tours going on every Saturday throughout the summer through Labor Day weekend. Those are going to be every Saturday at 11 a.m., and we meet at the Cedar Street Bridge. So check that out. You can get tickets at our website, bonnercountyhistory.org.
Well, okay. That's about it. We're out of time, folks. Thanks for listening to the Community Character Hour. Chris, thanks again so much for being here. Hannah, Heather, as always.
This was so exhilarating. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me.